Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young, it's Here and Now. Some of the nation's so-called citizen soldiers are finding out they may be sent back to Iraq sooner than expected. The New York Times reported yesterday that the Pentagon plans to send 14,000 more National Guard units to Iraq to meet the demands of President Bush's troop surge. The units reportedly would come from Arkansas, Indiana, Oklahoma, and Ohio, soldiers who already have been deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan and might be sent back as early as next year. In some cases, that's a full 2 years earlier than planned. The Associated Press is reporting that Guard combat units heading to Iraq will be on active duty for longer than 12 months, despite the Pentagon's new pledge to limit deployments to 1 year. We'll speak with a member of the National Guard in just a moment, but first, joining us on the line is the Adjutant General of the Indiana National Guard, Major General R. Martin Umbarger. Thanks for joining us, General Umbarger.
Great. Pleased to be with you.
We understand that the 76th Infantry Brigade of the Indiana National Guard would be affected by this Pentagon plan. When would they go and where? Do you know?
Well, we don't know exactly when. We have been told and notified that they've been nominated to go, we feel, sometime in the 08 time frame. Mm-hmm. And we have been told it's in a mission would be in Iraq.
And for many of these soldiers, is that earlier than they expected?
Yes, you know, we've had a strategy. It's really not been a policy, but we've tried to have a strategy where we try to say to our soldiers and their families and their employers that if a soldier is deployed for a year, that we would try to have the dwell time where he or she would not have to go back with, say, 4 to 5 years home a year deployed. And for my organization here, it would be somewhat less than that.
Mm-hmm. And have these soldiers already been deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan?
You know, I would say the preponderance of the organization would be yes. They have not gone as a full unit, the full brigade. They have gone in battalions here, battalions there. But overall, every one of the units within that organization has been deployed somewhere since 9/11.
Mm-hmm. And what are the troops saying about this?
You know, the troops are kind of amazing, really. What the feedback I'm getting from my leaders, they had kind of heard rumors with the buildup that there might be where organizations may have to move earlier in the deployment plan. And, you know, a comment that we get is we're glad the rumors are over. We kind of know we can start the plan. We can deal with our families and our employers and get prepared to go. We're a pretty ready brigade, and I think that's why we were chosen.
Mm-hmm. When you say a ready brigade, does that mean that your enrollment is up?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. We've had 3 strong years of recruiting and retention in the Indiana National Guard. There's a lot of young men and women of this younger generation that really, truly want to serve.
Mm-hmm. The New York Times wrote about this plan and talked about Indiana and Arkansas and Oklahoma. They quoted some of the National Guard officials in Arkansas and Oklahoma as expressing some concerns about things such as resources for a short turnaround and training. If we talk about resources and equipment, in Oklahoma, apparently, officials there say about one-third of the soldiers don't have the appropriate rifles that would be needed. Is this a major challenge, would you say, for your troops in Indiana as well, equipment?
You know, I would say that's pretty much across the board in the nation. In order to support the soldiers and airmen, sailors, Marines that are going over into harm's way, we've had to move a lot of equipment from state to state to support the fight. Not only weapons, but night vision goggles, communication equipment, and vehicles. But what I have found since being the Adjutant General, that any units that we do deploy, when they get to the mobilization station, they are fitted with the proper equipment. They are given it, and they go over well equipped. But I will tell you, the brigade does have tremendous shortages of equipment as it stands right now. So over the next year, as we prepare them to go to this, we will begin that process of filling all those gaps.
Mm-hmm. What about training? I understand that under this plan, the officers would have less time to train, but they could do so closer to home.
Well, you know, we can do a lot in a year's period of time to get them ready. And the other thing we need to realize is that a tremendous number of the leadership of our non-commissioned officers and officers are combat veterans. I mean, we have a tremendous amount of experience in all our formations now.
And what about affording all of this equipment and the healthcare and the training? Is there, do you think, enough support, especially when you hear about the debate in Congress right now, to be able to afford this?
Well, I will just say this, that there isn't an elected official, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, that doesn't, regardless of what they feel about the war, they do want to take care of our soldiers and get them the proper equipment. I don't think that would be an issue. And it has not been up to this point. You know, the Army Guard, Army and Air Guard has been there since 9/11, and, you know, we unprecedented use of our soldiers, and they have done it, and, you know, we owe it to them to assure that they have all the health and all the equipment they need before they go into harm's way, and I think our nation will do that.
And among the troops, you've said that they've responded well to this plan, but there's got to be a considerable amount of strain on the families of some of the National Guard members. Is there enough popular support to do this as well?
You know, I don't. You know, our families do pay the biggest price. I say that often, that it's they're the unsung heroes that stay home and keep things going. We have a very, very strong family support program that we have within all our states, and we work with them. And the other thing for Guardsmen we can't forget about is the employers. You know, a lot of them are employed by small-town America. You know, maybe they're 1 of 5, 10 employees. That really hurts our employers. So that all has to be thought, and there will be a lot of stress and strain to those families and employers, yes.
Can you explain the length of deployments? National Guard and Reserve soldiers are supposed to serve 24 months of active duty in 5 years?
You know, that was like a policy when the new Secretary of Defense came in, that's kind of been changed. What there was something that came out of the new policy that I'm personally pleased with is the deployments were up to 18 months long with 12 months boots on the ground in theater. Now the policy has been put out to where just a 12-month mobilization. So instead of a soldier being gone from his family employer for a year and a half, even though you only get a year in country, now we're talking just gone a full year. So that's a little more predictability when they're going to be coming home, and that shortens that period of time.
And that 12 months would include training time.
Yeah, 12 months would include training time. Mm-hmm. So it will probably, the net result would be more like 9 to 10 months actually in theater.
And that is a definitive policy change at this point? It's a promise?
I would assume that's the policy of which this, once we do get the official notification of this deployment, that's what the guidance we will receive.
I understand you've got about 15,000 troops in the Indiana National Guard.
Yeah, right around 14,000.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And this plan calls for 3,500 soldiers going over to Iraq next year. That's a large number.
Yeah, that is the largest unit of soldiers that we've deployed probably since World War II out of the Indiana National Guard.
And how do you think that affects, first of all, troop morale, as we talked about briefly before, but also about troop readiness here at home?
Well, you know, if you take those numbers, I mean, I'm still, you know, I still got over 60% of my force left back here in the state. So we feel comfortable that we would be able to take care of our state duties for our citizens here in Indiana as well.
Mm-hmm. All right. Major General Umberger, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you, ma'am.
Major General Martin Umberger is Adjutant General of the Indiana National Guard. Joining us to talk further about this is Lieutenant Colonel Tim Tombolson. He's a member of the 76th Infantry Brigade of the Indiana National Guard, which, under that Pentagon plan, would return to Iraq as early as next year. Thanks very much for speaking with us, Lieutenant Colonel.
Thank you, ma'am.
I understand you may be going to Iraq next year as part of this new plan from the Pentagon, and you were in Iraq in 2003. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am. 2003 to 2004.
Mm-hmm. And your wife is also in the Indiana National Guard, and she just returned from Iraq last year.
Yes, she's been home a year and a couple months now.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel about this plan to have the brigade return to Iraq next year?
Ma'am, if there's a requirement as a soldier, then we'll support those requirements.
Mm-hmm. Do you have children?
Yes, ma'am. Two children. A son that's 7 and a daughter that's 4.
Mm-hmm. Is it difficult, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I think any parent that wasn't concerned about their young children in their absence. But yes, it is.
Right, right. And repeated deployments must be increasingly difficult. The New York Times is actually doing a story today about some of the stresses on families because of these repeated deployments. And the article says that the Army is contracting out for private therapists to help families deal with these stresses.
Well, I can tell you that our extended family, my parents, my brothers and sisters, Deidre's brother, help a great deal during both of our absences. One thing I will say as a father who was here while my wife was deployed was I know my children very well, probably better than some other parents, and I was a single parent. You know, there are thousands of single parents in America that work through this. They have good days and bad days, just as they would have with both parents in the household.
Hmm. How was it the last time you were in Iraq in 2003? How would you describe it?
You know, I will say that it was a very fulfilling part of my life. Yes, separation anxiety. Yes, good days, bad days. But the Iraqi people, when we went there, were so excited to have us there. And one of, I guess, one of my experiences a few weeks into the war, we found a car that had just ran into a canal, helped an elderly gentleman out, and he was laying there on the side of the road, pretty beat up. He looked up at me, he said, "Thank you for coming to get Saddam." And he was a pediatrician, and it kind of it clicked with me right then and there that this pediatrician in a different place might be helping my children, and right now in this place, we're helping him. And he was, you know, extremely grateful at that point in time.
And that was 2003, right after the war started, and until 2004. When you read about what's happening in Iraq now, it sounds like a different place, maybe, doesn't it?
Yes, ma'am. I know what you and I see in the news and hear. But I'm sure there are good things going on there right now.
Mm-hmm. How have your colleagues reacted to this plan to send your unit back to Iraq as early as next year?
It's not a shock by any means. Certainly the perspective has changed. I spent 19 years of my career without a combat deployment. I think as the soldiers that are enlisting today know that this is a different environment that they're enlisting in, and we're so proud of these young soldiers that are enlisting now because they're raising their hand knowing that their country's at war.
Well, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Okay.
Lieutenant Colonel Tim Tomlinson is a member of the 76th Infantry Brigade of the Indiana National Guard, which is going back to Iraq next year. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Rebecca, it's here and now. The 79th Annual Academy Awards Ceremony takes place in Los Angeles this Sunday. One of the films creating the most buzz in Hollywood is Blood Diamond, mainly for its political message.
It came from the heart of the earth. A stone so rare, men will do anything to possess it. And all who touch it are left with blood on their hands.
Leonardo DiCaprio is up for a Best Actor Oscar for his portrayal of a diamond smuggler in Sierra Leone. Jimon Hanzu was nominated for Best Supporting Actor for his role as a man whose life has been torn apart by a civil war funded by illegal diamonds. We've reported on the issue of conflict diamonds in the past. Today, though, we'll check in to see if the movie has helped raise awareness. First, though, let's take a look at the role diamonds will play on the red carpet at the Oscars. We're joined by Heatha Prabhakar of Forbes.com. Welcome, Heatha.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start, first of all, will the stars be wearing fewer diamonds this year, maybe because of the Blood Diamond movie?
Actually, I don't think we're going to see a trend of that. We're going to just basically see the regular trend of stars wearing a lot of diamonds. And if anything, you're going to see stars wearing a lot darker colored diamonds. You have black diamonds, browns, and just darker shades. People like Neil Lane is designing these great diamond, they're like little like spheres that hang from the ear and on necklaces. And I think we're going to see a lot of that on the red carpet.
And how extraordinary will these diamonds be that are lent out?
Well, for example, Jennifer Hudson, Neil Lane actually told me that Jennifer Hudson is looking at a cuff bracelet called the Big Wide Diamond Bracelet. It has 50 carats of white diamonds, and that's going to be $150,000. Harry Winston wouldn't tell me who is wearing this number, but it's 31.19 carats D-flawless emerald-cut diamonds, and that is either could be worn as a pendant or a brooch, and that's costing several million dollars. They wouldn't give me the exact price. In addition, Van Cleef & Arpels has pulled out their museum collection from Paris to dress Catherine Deneuve, and she's going to be wearing this mystery clip diamond earring set with a bracelet, really beautiful, and that doesn't even have a price. It's so exquisite. It's just priceless.
Is it men wearing diamonds as well as women?
I think we're going to see a lot less of the bling on the men. You are seeing with men especially more of a trend of just being very sedate, very Cary Grant, I think, like old world classic Hollywood style.
Overall then, more diamonds than in the past or about the same?
I think we're going to see about the same. I initially had thought maybe the Blood Diamond movie and, you know, awareness of that political situation would affect the diamond industry, and it really hasn't. I think diamonds are as popular as ever.
Well, Heather Prabhakar from Forbes.com, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
We now turn to Karina Gilfillan of Global Witness. Her organization says the American jewelry industry is not doing enough to ensure that their diamonds are conflict-free. Karina, we just heard from Heather Prabhakar, who wrote about diamonds at the Oscars, and says really there's not going to be much change this year despite what could have been increased awareness from the movie Blood Diamond.
Well, you know, I think that is disappointing. I guess what I would hope is that with the release of Blood Diamond, more of actors and actresses and consumers are asking questions so that they're making sure that they're getting, they're buying or they're wearing diamonds from responsible jewelers.
And also, when we hear about diamonds at the Oscars, the U.S. diamond industry is donating $10,000 to African charities for each star that raises a hand adorned with a diamond ring at events like the Oscars. The director of the movie Blood Diamond says that this is a charitable bribe. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that this campaign is really, really distasteful. It's really insensitive to what people in Sierra Leone suffered. I mean, you had people in the brutal civil war in Sierra Leone that was fueled by diamonds, tens of thousands of people who died. You had people who had their arms chopped off from the RUF rebel groups that basically financed their war by diamonds. So I think it's a very distasteful campaign that's very insensitive to what happened there. I mean, I think if the diamond industry is really serious about solving this problem, they should focus less on these kinds of PR campaigns and more on actually changing their policies to make sure that diamonds never again fuel conflict and civil war.
You know, the World Diamond Council says that so-called blood diamonds make up really less than 1% of new diamonds, and they have taken steps since the 90s because that percentage actually used to be higher.
Well, you know, it's true that it has gotten better than it was in many cases because some of these civil wars, you know, ended. But I think that the UN has reported that blood diamonds are still reaching the international marketplace. We still have violence around diamonds happening in the eastern part of the Congo and Africa. So there is still a problem. And given the brutal conflicts that happened, you know, we can't allow this to happen again. So we've just done a survey, Global Witness and Amnesty International, showing that the $33 billion a year American jewelry retail industry isn't taking adequate measures to avoid conflict diamonds. And so I guess what we want to see is primarily is the retail sector and all other sectors of the diamond industry to be very proactive in where they're sourcing their diamonds and to take proactive auditing measures to make sure that their policies to combat blood diamonds are actually effective in practice. Over 56% of those who did respond to our survey didn't have those kinds of basic measures in place.
So do you think the movie Blood Diamond has done anything about this issue?
Absolutely. I think that there's in the United States there's a lot more awareness now of this problem, of the role of diamonds in fueling conflict. We have have developed a consumer guide that gives some basic questions that consumers can ask when they're buying diamond jewelry, just to try and ensure that they're buying from a responsible jeweler who's taken adequate measures. You know, of course, I think the other important player in all this is the governments, the United States government and the other governments trading in diamonds. Basically, is that those governments need to do a lot better job of monitoring and holding the diamond industry to account and making sure that all players of the industry are complying with the laws. So I think that's another thing that members of the public and actresses in Hollywood could also weigh in with government and say, what are you doing to make sure that this international efforts to combat blood diamonds are effective and that you're regulating the industry enough? So I think that's another thing that people can do.
Karina Gilfillan of Global Witness, she's been talking with us about conflict diamonds, gems that are used to fund conflicts in Africa. Thanks very much for speaking with us, Karina.
Thank you.
Next week on Here and Now, senators are expected to take up a resolution that could go as far as revoking the powers they gave President Bush to go to war in Iraq. Also, we'll check in on the presidential campaign trail and delve into a music critic's guilty pleasures. That's Monday. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now. Funding for Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young, it's Here and Now. U.S. National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley is in Moscow this week, meeting with Russian officials about several issues, including the recent heated comments from President Vladimir Putin. At a security conference in Germany, Putin bluntly criticized U.S. plans for a missile defense system in Eastern Europe. He said, quote, the U.S. has overstepped its national borders in every way and is fostering a global arms race. Hadley is downplaying this rhetoric. Others are calling it extraordinary. To help us understand the state of U.S.-Russia relations and whether they're getting frosty, we're joined by Barry Posen. He's head of the Security Studies Program at MIT. And Barry, what do you make of these comments from President Putin?
Well, he's not the first to react to the nature of American post-Cold War foreign policy. The post-Cold War period left the Americans with enormous amount of power in the world, and the Americans, whether they've been Democrats or Republicans, have been willing to use it and willing to use it rather expansively, given Russia's heritage or legacy of having been the last great power to really tilt with the United States. I think they feel the American dominance a little more imminently. And then the second thing, of course, is that Russia's situation has changed a little bit. After the Cold War, Russia collapsed faster, I think, than anyone expected. Then we got very used to them being weak and sort of supine. And now Russia has managed to recover a bit, partly on the strength of its energy industry and partly on the strength of Putin's, let us say, authoritarian ways, which have reconcentrated a lot of power in the center.
So is this sort of an expression of confidence on the part of Russia, really? I heard one Russian aide was quoted as saying, this is really a way for us to say Russia is a force to be reckoned with.
You know, different power centers' way of expressing their belief that they're forced to be reckoned with varies with national culture. Russian diplomacy is not without a certain bumptious tradition, and they may have said, you know, we're back or we're here in a way that's a little more bumptious than maybe some other countries might say it. But yes, that's essentially the message.
So the speculation that this is a return to a Cold War-style confrontation between the United States and Russia, what would you say?
I think that's the wrong model. I think American analysts, American people, American journalists, they only have two models of international politics in their heads. One model is the sort of bipolar, global, total competition on everything, economics, military, ideology, the kind of Manichaean struggle of good and evil. That's one model we have. The post-Cold War model that the Americans have in their heads, in contrast to the Cold War model, is a model where the Americans are very strong and others follow along, others are weak. Basically, the expectation was that the post-Cold War world would turn into a kind of a coalition of democracies in which the Americans were sort of the chairman of the board. And this was, you know, this was sort of the way things went for about 10 years. Russia was considered to be a junior democracy that was somehow coming along, and China might be a challenge in the future, but, you know, maybe we could, you know, bring it into this system that we were organizing. So there are these two, as I said, there's these two models. There's the intensely competitive bipolar model, or there's the American leadership, chairman of the board, we're all liberal democracies, we all share interests kind of model. And there's a third model that people have forgotten. And the model that people have forgotten is a model call it, for want of a better term, we might call normal international politics. And this is the way international politics was played for generations in the world, often multipolar international politics, because rather than have one great power or two great powers, usually there were five, six, seven great powers. Now, we're in a kind of a period of flux now, and I think that it is still very, very much the fact of the case that U.S. capabilities and influence far exceed that of any other power. So those who use the term unipolar world to describe the current situation, which Putin was complaining about in his speech, are essentially right. It is a unipolar world. That said, the other power centers in the world are starting to have sharper elbows. They're starting to find their footing. They're starting to find it uncomfortable for the Americans to have so much freedom of action. And I think what the Americans have to get used to, and I think it's what Putin was saying and what Jacques Chirac used to say, what they're saying is that there's a number of new power centers in the world. They're not in the American League. Because of the funny way that American power is expressed, they're not all going to form one cohesive coalition against us, but they're going to be fluid coalitions that try and limit American capability. And the states that you read about in the papers are the ones that are going to be the important players, or the coalitions are going to be important players. So Russia's an important player, China important player, India important player, the European Union, which is basically an important player, and Japan's an important player. And then there's some sort of, there's kind of a middle league that people are starting to talk about, and it's not just Putin. So some people talk a lot about Brazil, believe it or not, as a potential rising power, right? So these states, one day they'll be with us, the next day they may be against us. And we have to get used to it and not try and force this new model of international politics into this old mode of saying, well, it's a new Cold War.
And this specific tactic that we're referring to in the Putin speech about this missile defense system that would be put in Europe, there seems to be real distrust on the part of Russia.
Well, yeah, and I myself have not had a chance to research the parameters of this technology. But I think the larger point is what bothers the Russians. Cold War ended. They relinquished the Warsaw Pact. Many republics of the former Soviet Union were also, left the fold. And I think their understanding, Western policymakers led them to, was that we would not take too much advantage of this. We would not push Western military forces up to Russia's borders. And it wouldn't be that much of a surprise to me if it's the precedent that bothers the Russians as much as anything else. This is, what we see from you for the last 20 years is a pattern of pushing up to our borders. The dirty little secret is the so-called second strike capability, which is the anchor of a stable strategic nuclear relationship. The Russian second strike capability is actually a little bit flimsy right now. And so Putin probably knows that his force is a little bit flimsy right now. And the idea that this extra technology would be thrown into the mix can't make him feel good and can't make his generals feel good. If you want to ask in a material sense, where is there a state that sometime on the horizon could move into a capabilities class that makes it competitive with the United States, the typical state of concern is China these days. It's not Russia. And it's because China's economy is growing at such a furious pace. With economic power comes military power. Now, there are a lot of disagreements about the timelines on this. Can the Chinese sustain this kind of incredible nearly 10% growth rate year in, year out? In the nearer term, what the problems are, or is not so much a threat to our capability, but challenges to how much freedom of action our capability is going to allow us. And that has to do with what others are willing to do to try and constrain us. The Russians still have a pretty active armaments base, and they can sell weapons to people that we would like to be able to push around. So they've sold some weapons to Iran in the same way that China has sold some weapons to Iran. They could have sold more, by the way. It's not that they sell everything. In other words, they haven't given away the family jewels, but they sell some things that raise our cost.
Well, Barry Posen, MIT professor of political science and director of the Security Studies Program, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And later in the show, Oscar nominee Tom Perata on turning Little Children, his book about the dark side of suburbia, into a film. You're listening to Here and Now. A tree grows in Brooklyn, and now a beaver swims in the Bronx. That's right. For the first time in 200 years, the North American beaver has returned to the Big Apple. A beaver lodge has been discovered on the banks of the Bronx River, not far from a busy intersection and a parking lot. Scientists say this discovery is another sign that an aggressive river cleanup effort is paying off. Biologists videotaped this beaver and have nicknamed him Jose, after Congressman Jose Serrano, who represents the area and has been the leader of the Bronx River cleanup effort. And Congressman Serrano joins us now on the line from his office in the Bronx. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Well, have you seen the beaver yet?
I have not seen the beaver. They've arranged for me to see the beaver later today. And it will be quite an experience to see a beaver named Jose. I never thought that they had names like Jose.
Well, what do you know about the beaver so far?
Well, what I know about the beaver is that it shocked a lot of folks, including this congressman. I suspect that when we started to clean up the river a long time ago to try to get a taste of what suburban or rural life was like in the asphalt areas of New York, we suspected that the river would be clean and we would have boating on it and we would have other activities. But life, that was something else. And recently we introduced herring into the river, and now a beaver. I mean, this is really a great comeback, and it is seriously a very great story. And beautifully, in an ironic way, that the beaver is the state animal, and it left 200 years ago because trappers and other people were building and rebuilding, and it had no place to go. And now it's come back. It's really quite a statement.
Right. So this cleanup effort that's been underway in the Bronx River, this really started, 15 years ago or so? Can you explain it a little bit?
A long time ago, people always knew that this river was here. It was the Bronx River. It runs 23 miles from Westchester County through the Bronx. People wanted to do something with it, but there was nothing much you could do with a river in the city. So when I became a member of the Appropriations Committee, in all honesty, I looked at dollars that were available, and I said, why do these dollars only get used in rural and suburban areas? Why can't they be used in the middle of a city? So we began to get dollars to clean up the river. We got the Army Corps of Engineers, and I remember the first Saturday we showed up at the river, everything that you could possibly imagine, and some things that cannot be mentioned on radio, were found in the river. I remember tires coming out. I remember half of a Jeep coming out. I remember everything that nobody wanted for 200 years coming out of that river. But along with the cleanup, the river became a symbol of everything that happened in the community, of an environmental movement, of a desire for park space, of a desire for greenways, of a desire for young people to participate in filmmaking and in poetry writing and everything surrounding the environmental movement. And no one thought that in the middle of a city, people would care about an environmental movement. That was usually seen as something, in all honesty, for young, middle-class white folks in the suburbs, not in the city. And yet the city was polluted. And the river has become the symbol of that movement and that renaissance. And to have life back in the river and to have the beaver, the state symbol, come join us, it's really an amazing story, and one that really makes you feel that all this work has been worthwhile.
Mm. Well, what's your vision, do you think, for the future of the river?
In the future, we will see more canoeing. We are building a path along the side of the river for biking and jogging and walking. There are now two parks that have opened up. One, and all these parks have the river or the waterway as a background. There is one that looks right onto the river. And that is the whole thrust of what we're doing here in the Bronx now.
So do you think Jose will stay around for a while?
I think Jose is going to stay around for a while. I hear Jose is waiting for a mate. And chances are some female will join him shortly from upstate. That's what the scientists tell me. And we're all rooting for him to stay, to continue to build. And I have to tell you a very funny story. The day that I found out about the beaver, I was having a meeting with the Army Corps of Engineers. And the leader looks at me and says, I'm very jealous. I said, of a beaver? He says, they're better engineers than anyone else.
Congressman Serrano, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Jose Serrano is a congressman from New York City. We've been speaking with him about the return of the beaver to the Big Apple. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Becker, it's here and now. One of those who will be waiting to hear if his name is called at Sunday's Academy Awards is Belmont, Massachusetts author Tom Perotta. Perotta's up for an Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay for Little Children, which he and director Todd Field wrote from his novel of the same name. Little Children is a dark tale of a suburban town where the arrival of a convicted pedophile is only one of many disturbing details that lie under a seemingly perfect surface. In this scene, Kate Winslet, who's also up for an Oscar for her role as a frustrated stay-at-home mom in this film, is egged on by a group of other moms and approaches a stay-at-home dad, who's played by Patrick Wilson, and this approach takes place on the playground.
One of them bet me $5. I couldn't get your phone number.
$5, huh?
Yeah.
But couldn't we split it 50-50?
It could be arranged. It doesn't have to be your real number.
Oh, well, in that case, sure. You got a pen?
Great. Oh, I don't.
Well?
No, wait, just... Wait. You know what? It'd really be funny if you gave me a hug.
That hug leads to a kiss and much more. Robin Young spoke with Tom Perotta about his work in adapting Little Children from page to screen. But to begin with, there was something she had to get out of the way.
Okay, so first question. I already know the answer, but what neighborhood do you live in? mothers who come across as a coven of harpies in the playground, another we just heard, who seems to view her daughter as, you know, something sort of annoying, who carries out a public affair with that stay-at-home dad after she kisses him, a child predator, his overprotective mom, and a vigilante cop. Who are we supposed to root for?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, in a story like this, I think I just want to do justice to all the characters. I think even when I'm writing it, I'm not rooting for anybody. I'm just sort of exploring their lives. I mean...
It's funny you say that, Tom, because I thought you were going to say, for the children.
Oh? You know? That would be responsible of me, wouldn't it?
Because I felt myself through the movie saying, pay attention. Your child is right there, you know. Meanwhile, they all think they are paying attention because they're running around like crazy with this concern that a child predator is in the neighborhood. But at the same time seem to be ignoring their children while they carry out affairs and things.
Right, right. Well, in a way, that very germ of Little Children was the shock that certain adults feel when you become a parent and suddenly it's like your own story gets put on hold. And for a lot of people, that's great. That's the time of your life. You want to sort of let your kid be the focus. But I also think there are a lot of people who are not ready at that moment to put their lives on hold and feel secretly resentful about that, or just like there's something that they need to feel alive. Somebody like Kate Winslet, there,
she's the stay-at-home mom who's discovered her husband, and this is mature adult themes. She's discovered her husband masturbating while watching computer pornography. She's, as we said, started this affair. And she's in this scene at a book club where they're talking about the novel Emma Bovary, Flaubert's tale of the doctor's wife who had affairs to escape her boredom. And it obviously resonates with Kate Winslet's character. Let's listen.
When I read it in grad school, Madame Bovary just seemed like a fool. She marries the wrong man, makes one foolish mistake after another. But when I read it this time, I just fell in love with her. She's trapped. But she has a choice. She can either accept a life of misery or she can struggle against it. And she chooses to struggle.
You know, as a writer, you can't have your character just very bluntly explain herself normally. But here she's in the book group, she's talking about Madame Bovary, but we quickly realize she's talking about herself, and we get to listen to her think aloud about just what it is she thinks she's doing, because, as you say, she's in a kind of indefensible position. She's carrying on an affair with a man in the neighborhood. And here you see that not only is she justifying it, she's trying to talk about it in very romantic, almost, you know, political terms.
Well, we've read that Kate Winslet said that that was the most difficult thing for her because she's so connected to her own family and her own children. We also read that she was very involved in bringing in details from your book. For instance, insisting on painting her toenails blue, because that was in the book?
That's right. Yeah, she was great about that. In the movie, all you get is one glimpse of her blue toenails, which is a sort of an anecdote in the book. You know exactly why she's painted her toes blue, and it's related to she's ashamed of her toes. She has toenail fungus, as many people do, and she's gotten into this affair, and she's going through a whole kind of makeover. She's gotten this new bikini, you know, she's suddenly very conscious of her body because there's a man who's paying attention to her. Her husband, as we know, is
was
off
not, right.
paying attention to his computer. And I was so pleased that Kate had thought to keep that detail, because I think for her to know that her toenails are blue, you know, in the moments when she's acting, somehow probably helps her to
right.
connect with that part of the character.
What were some other places in the film where there were details from the book that were important from you that were there? I mean, obviously there were many, but were there a few others that were just there because it helped the character?
There's a character played by Jackie Earle Haley who is a sex offender and perhaps worse. In the book, you know, we hear about a number of things done to him. His house is leafleted. There's a minor case of arson. And somebody spray paints the word evil on his driveway with an arrow pointing to the house. And it's one of those things, I imagined it one way in my head, but in the film, it comes as such a surprise. He opens the door, and it's shot from above, and you just see those words.
Mm-hmm.
It has a kind of visceral power that, you know, I just didn't expect, even though it came straight from the book.
Well, Jackie Earle Haley's pedophile character, something happens to him in the end, and now, without giving away the ending of the film, it does diverge from the book. It's more hopeful, but it's also more shocking. I never saw it coming.
Yeah, and I didn't either. You know, this is one of those funny things about collaborating. Todd and I were both kind of groping for a way to make this emotional journey pay off, and he called me one morning and said, "I know what happens." And he told me what it was, and I, you know, it took me days to kind of absorb what he wanted to do. And,
yeah, because this is your character.
Yeah, and it's something that I never would have gotten to on my own, frankly. So I give him a lot of credit for that.
And for the poor people who are having to listen to this, not having read either the book or the film, we'll just say that something, you know, pretty shocking happens with the child predator that makes you suddenly see him in a different way. It makes the other characters see him in a different way.
Yeah, and it's an amazing performance by Jackie Earle Haley.
Right. By the way, the film has an unseen narrator. He sounds like the narrator for Nova.
He's the narrator for Frontline.
Frontline. I was just going to say Frontline, too.
Yeah, and, you know, Todd Field came to me the very first day we met and said, "Here's what I want to do. I want to have a narrator, and I want him to be Will Lyman from Frontline."
Sure.
And he went and he got him, and it turned out to be a brilliant stroke.
Will Lyman, also a well-known actor here in the Boston area.
That's right.
But why did you do that? I mean, that feeling of a PBS special.
It gives the viewer a little bit of distance. For me, it became a really comic device. Because you have this calm, mature observer telling you this story that involves a bunch of characters running around, behaving sort of hysterically. And, you know, when you asked me at first, you know, who are you rooting for? We did take a kind of, as much as we could, a kind of objective stance. Like, let's watch our characters. Let's not root for them. Let's just watch and see what they do. As a writer, the judgment for me isn't, you know, are they behaving in ways that I approve of or ways I don't approve of, but are they behaving in ways that seem plausible?
Well, Tom Parada, what's next for you? We hear you're working on a new novel, and we just want to say you've occasionally played poker with our colleague Chris Ballman. So can you reassure him that your next book won't be about a group of guys playing poker?
It will not technically be about...
Uh-oh.
There is one scene where a group of guys play poker. This is a novel called The Abstinence Teacher, which is about sex education and religion and the culture wars.
Mm-hmm.
But there is, in fact... a poker scene, and I apologize in advance to Chris and everyone else.
They thought you were taking notes. Tom Parada, nominated along with Todd Field for Best Adapted Screenplay for Little Children, taken from his novel Little Children. Tom Parada, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
The Academy Awards are this Sunday. Robin Young will be back on Monday.
Sunday night, now I know.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.